Shifting gears from talking about how we destroy wetlands and the problems with wetlands and all those depressing things to talking about the importance of wetlands and the values of wetlands and what you all need to know to be able to sell wetlands as being important ecosystems to society and ultimately to the public, etc. There's lots of different values, and we all benefit from those, and we're going to talk about those. And human civilization has always, it originated very likely around wetlands for thousands and thousands of years. There's lots of history, documented history, Tigris and Euphrates rivers in southern Iraq, the Atchafalaya Basin area, Louisiana. And as we already mentioned, you know, wetlands have really been given a sinister image, and that's unfortunate because they are extremely productive and important systems. Okay, we can look at wetland values. We can throw those into three different categories: biological values, environmental values, and societal values. And some of those values are outlined in in this handout here. So it's wetland functions and values, and we're going to go through some of those. On the other side, just incidentally, with going back to and stuff and talking about shoals and valley floods. This the whole paper. That's a pretty good just overview by Tim Deal with USGS. Pretty good description of what is a shoal and a valley plug, and that paper is on the website if you want to read the whole thing. But okay, so they fall into three categories: biological values, which include things such as providing habitat for wetland-dependent species, such as that animal there, which is okay. Aquatic and terrestrial fish and wildlife habitat, so habitat or animals that depend on aquatic systems and also terrestrial systems, and these are also, we're going to talk about each of these are also important areas, important reservoirs of biodiversity. Lots of different species use wetlands. Lots of different species, some of the most species-rich areas. Environmental values include, ironically, flood control. These act as buffer areas and store flood waters, although through human history, our goal with our industrial minds had been, no, we don't need wetlands, we need to drain the wetlands, and we can control the floods by creating these chutes to shunt water, etc., but we've learned through time we're not as effective as Mother Nature, although engineers love to try to control systems, natural systems. Another is groundwater replenishment, like we were talking about with the recharge wetlands, which we'll talk about a little more. So recharging that aquifer. Shoreline stabilization is another environmental value, and ultimately reducing erosion. And sediment and nutrient retention and export. So these are the areas, again, that can retain nutrients and sediment and even contaminants and can act as sinks for those. But also, they're highly productive systems that are producing lots of alkalinous material, lots of organic matter that ultimately can be flushed during overbank flooding or during rain events and be flushed into an aquatic system and help in help in systems, in the aquatic system cycling and being productive. There are also societal values, which really fall into consumptive and non-consumptive uses. Consumptive uses such as fur and timber harvest, non-consumptive uses such as recreation and tourism. There's also aesthetic value and economic value, which we'll talk about at the end. The economic value of wetlands versus other ecosystems. It'll be kind of surprising maybe for y'all. Okay, so that's kind of almost an outline of the entire lecture, and so we're going to go through each of these. Were you writing or something, or no? Okay.
We were just hoping that was commercial, not bad.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't even know what's all there. What does it look like? Yeah, raccoons, I can see that. Muskrat, yeah, I'm not sure what the others are. That's not a very good, clear picture. Okay, so biological values, wetland-dependent wildlife. All right, 80% of the birds in North America, breeding birds in North America, use wetlands. All right, so you take Dr. Bueller's class, you can tell him, you know what, you're, these are breeding birds total. 80% of those use wetlands. 50% of migratory birds use wetlands. And the majority of those are the water birds, shore birds, wading birds, and waterfowl, but lots of other birds. Warblers, etc., also use wetlands or depend on wetlands at different times of the year. As far as waterfowl and the importance of waterfowl is been estimated to contribute around $60 million in revenues per year. In the this is Mississippi Flyway, but this is the Lower Mississippi Valley area, contributed around $58 million. And two-thirds of the population of mallards, winters within the Mississippi Alluvial Valley. Two-thirds of the population of mallards.
Is that $58 million a year.
$58 million a year. And from the water bird perspective, these are using all different wetland types. Just to give you a feel of, since we're going to start to, especially next, or tomorrow, talk about managing wetlands for waterfowl and other wetland-dependent species, just to give you a feel for, these are total duck numbers on the bottom, and this is total pond numbers. And the important thing to recognize, this is north central United States, prairie pothole region, United States. This is prairie Canada, and the total on the top. And this is actually total number of May ponds. So this is, you know, wetlands that are flooded. And if you kind of look, you can notice how these things seem to mirror each other. That when you have high numbers in the mid-70s, 74, high numbers of wetlands during, or flooded wetlands in the summer, or well, in May, you have high numbers of birds that are produced. And as those numbers decrease, like we saw during the early 90s, you have a decrease in the number of birds. So this really reflects, the number of wetlands reflects the number of waterfowl reflects the number of wetlands out there, and really kind of really reflects the dependency of waterfowl on wetlands, not only in the breeding areas, but as we'll talk about later, in the migrating wintering areas, and making sure that we provide habitat for them during migration and winter. Any questions? Okay. Other wetland-dependent wildlife, fish and shellfish. 95% of shellfish depend on wetlands. They primarily, wetlands are used for spawning and for nurseries. Spawning in freshwater and nurseries often in freshwater and saltwater systems, and in very important areas. It is estimated that $2 billion annually are generated from the commercial fisheries that are associated with species that depend on wetlands, and a lot of that is associated with saltwater species. Shrimp and fish harvests are just overall, shrimp and fish harvests throughout the world are positively correlated with national wetland area, which reflects the importance of wetlands for production of those commercial fisheries. This table here is a table that kind of breaks down dominant commercial and recreational fish in shellfish associated with wetlands. And first of all, you'll notice that most of this is a commercial harvest over here. Okay, the majority of our commercial harvest are 60% are saltwater fish. Again, these species are all dependent in some portion of their life stage on wetlands. And again, we have less with respect to freshwater, but on average, there's a paper that I read a few years ago that compared the amount that basically for freshwater that the average is spent on average harvest of a freshwater fish from a commercial standpoint, it's $350 per fish. And that in comparison, for recreation, it's about $18 per fish. And a lot of these are recreational type species that you see here, such as trout, etc. So this is a table here that shows commercial fisheries and the amount of fish that are produced. And that's correlated with economic revenue that's driven, which is certainly driven by our saltwater species. But from the recreational standpoint, freshwater species generate a tremendous amount of money within our country from the recreation standpoint. All right, what some other wetland-dependent species? We have reptiles and amphibians or herpetofauna, so lots of things like cottonmouth snakes and other types of snakes. alligators in Louisiana, $16 million a year is produced within the state from alligator farms. This is production of alligator meat and other species such as amphibians are dependent on wetlands. Amphibians, you can take, if you're interested in amphibians, I teach amphibian ecology and conservation every spring, take it as an elective. We talk lots about amphibians and importance of them as being indicator species, and many of these species are in decline within our state as well as around the world for a variety of reasons. So amphibians, many amphibians are dependent on wetlands. Mammals, what's that animal? Muskrat, okay. And 10 million pelts annually are produced or harvested annually and contribute to our economy. We'll talk a little bit more about about pelts here in a little bit with economic revenue and other wetland-dependent species and even in moose. Okay, other biological values, aquatic and terrestrial. So aquatic, we have lots of different fish species that use shallow areas, shallow wetlands for laying eggs, and correspondingly their fry survive within shallow emergent wetlands. We have terrestrial wildlife such as white-tailed deer or even zebra that use wetlands and dependent on those. And then you have a really kind of unique dynamic interaction of terrestrial wildlife dependent on aquatic wildlife interacting at that wetland interface or even consuming wetland-dependent species, such as you can see here with that Alaskan bear. And on the other side, you can have things like this. Here's a gator and that is a white-tailed deer. So you can have the aquatic side getting vicious on the terrestrial side, or the wetland side getting vicious on the terrestrial side. So the bottom line, top right there, many species use wetlands. Many aquatic and terrestrial species use them opportunistically or facultatively, which means as as opportunities exist. So. All right. The wetlands are highly productive areas and lots of opportunities for niche partitioning, so lots of different species. 4% of, I already mentioned this, of Earth's surface is covered by wetlands, and it's pretty amazing considering that 40% of the world's species depend on freshwater wetlands alone. So these areas are highly important and productive systems with respect to biodiversity of the world. The species richness and the net primary productivity of wetlands, and especially tidal estuarine wetlands, are the most productive system out of all the wetland systems, rivals that of tropical rainforests. So very, very productive systems. Some of the this is a Great Barrier Reef. This is not really a wetland system, but Great Barrier Reef, there's 1,500 fish species and over 4,000 mollusk species. But 25% of marine life depend on coral reefs and estuarine wetlands. So as I've already mentioned, that it is marine systems are highly dependent on the production of estuarine wetlands. And that ties into, again, biodiversity, but also ties into commercial fisheries production. 50% of listed species in the United States, 50% of the listed, federally listed species in the United States occur in wetlands. Here's a breakdown of, of number of endangered and threatened species, and the percentage of the U.S. total that are threatened. And you can see here percentage of species that are threatened for reptiles, amphibians, and mussels are very high. Birds is pretty high too. And especially with respect to amphibians, reptiles, and mussels, many of these animals are dependent on wetlands. And a good portion, as we already talked about, of birds are dependent on wetlands. These statistics here are just some that I came across. In Florida, 35% of their reptiles are listed, and around 20% of their amphibians. So the other thing that I have just underneath the biological values, but really is more from the human value standpoint, is that many of these species that are disappearing could have unknown medicinal uses, and lots of species that depend on wetlands. There's a gastric brood-rearing frog that is from Australia that basically had the capability of turning off its gastrointestinal system, and ultimately what it would do, its life history strategy was to consume its fertilized eggs, and then those eggs actually developed a process called direct development within the gut of the amphibian, and during that time the amphibian would not eat. And at that time, it turned off its gastrointestinal system, and then it would emerge as a metamorph, and that was part of its life history. That species is extinct now. And if we just think about the capabilities of learning about how that amphibian turns off its gastrointestinal system, that could, if we could have tapped into that, we could potentially cure a lot of issues that people have with gastrointestinal problems, with ulcers, etc. Various unknown medicinal things. Actually, skin peptides from the African clawed frog Xenopus laevis have been isolated and been shown to inactivate HIV. And so, lots of things that we can potentially, just from a human standpoint, capitalize off of species And again, with wetlands being an area biological biodiversity hotspot, it's important to conserve these systems as well as the species that exist within them. All right, moving on to environmental values. The first is flood control. And wetlands work in two ways to conserve flood control or to reduce flood control. They can store water. I think this is even one of the questions on anything. Store water and they can buffer discharge. Those are the two things, store water and buffer discharge. So you have runoff coming in here, they store the water, and ultimately they slow the discharge into an aquatic system. That's how they control. They store and they buffer. That's how they control flooding. They have a buffering effect, which is this kind of shows this, ultimately this bottom picture here. You have lots of runoff coming, and that, again, that wetland buffers the effect of runoff into the aquatic system. 1 hectare of wetland can store around 15,000 cubic meters of flood water. And it's been estimated that just 10 meters of wetland can dissipate 1/2 of the energy in a wave. So again, this can act as a in buffering storm surges, such as with Katrina, et cetera. And of course, we've already talked about deforestation and channelization. What it effectively does is prevents this buffering and storage opportunity because we're just shunning water. Well, again, there's problems with that we already talked about with water backing up at confluences and all this type of stuff. It has been estimated that back in the 1500s, water that hit a landscape and in a hardwood bottomland forest within the Mississippi Alluvial Valley, that if you just took a drop of rain and looked to see how long does it take to get to the Mississippi River, assuming it hit a tributary, that it would take about 60 days, and that now it occurs in about 12 days. So yes, we have been quite efficient at shunting water through our channels and et cetera by removing wetlands and creating these channels, but that creates problems, creates flooding downstream, creates these sedimentation issues, et cetera. Whereas this natural buffering effect that would happen because you had this buffer in place and the storage system in place, if we wouldn't have removed our wetlands and built in the floodplains or developed the floodplains, we would have very, very, very few issues with respect to flooding, which costs billions and billions and billions of dollars every year. Just in 1993, we had a pretty severe flood in the Mississippi River, and lots of damage that happened. Here's some flooded farmhouses down here. Estimated around $16 billion in flood damage just from that one flood event in June, I think, of 93. And this happens every year, though. I mean, it's billions of dollars every year that are going to deal with flood damage. Wetlands can prevent that. In fact, it was estimated Charles River Basin, which is somewhere around D.C. area, is a 3,400-hectare wetland. They were lobbying to have this completely developed, drained, and removed, etc. And the Corps itself did an economic analysis of what could happen if you remove that wetland with respect to the likelihood of flood damage. And this is kind of almost a seminal study that was done. And I think this was done in the 80s, and they estimated that if you remove this wetland, it's going to result in flood damages equaling around $17 million a year in this region. And they had lots of data to support that. So again, I already mentioned this. Basically, the two functions is, again, it stores water, it slows the velocity, acts as a buffer, so it slows the velocity, it stores water, creates this buffering effect with respect to how wetlands prevent flooding. So, any questions? Pretty clear? All right. All right, shoreline stabilization is pretty self-explanatory. In plants, etc., they have roots which help stabilize the shoreline, less likely for erosion to occur, like you can see here. It holds it all in. Plus, if this is, if you have wetland vegetation along here, it reduces the amount of no disturbance. It reduces the amount of sediment that'll come into that water system, and it also can result in, especially in cases where you have mangrove systems and estuarine wetlands, you can buffer ocean storm surges. 2004, when I first got here, there were four hurricanes that came through our area, and there was $25 billion in damage that occurred in the United States, a lot of those in the coastal regions. And a lot of them, and some of that in the interior of the United States, parts of North Carolina got nailed by Ivan because there was so much rain. Again, unstable banks, lots of flooding, bank destabilization, etc. Houses washing away.
What was the number of burns?
Number of people that died. Okay, so a few people died. Lots of damage. Speaking of folks dying, the tsunami of 2004, which you all remember. There's the storm surge from the tsunami. And that is actually a person standing there. That person is dead. And no kidding. And actually, apparently, the person that took this picture is dead, too, and they found the camera. And so, you know, that's a pretty big wall of water. And again, here's, this is a part of Indonesia. You can see, again, we're not, it's just not us guilty of building right to, you can see this all over the world, building right to the shoreline. And here's some mangroves right here. Certainly, mangroves existed all around here. And it's pretty hard to buffer a tsunami that's that massive, but still there is a buffering effect that would have occurred. And this is before and after the tsunami here. And, you know, large percentage of this low-lying area just completely flooded. Actually, less $20 billion in damage in 11 countries. Things are less expensive and less extravagant over in that part of the world compared to what I say here, $25 billion from those hurricanes just in the United States. But loss of life was massive, as you all recall, 300,000 folks dying. So again, wetlands can act as an important buffer to storm events. They can stabilize shorelines and store water, etc. And we already talked about hurricanes, Katrina and Rita both. I guess we didn't talk about Rita too much. All right, any questions on that? Another environmental value is groundwater replenishment. Particularly in the context of recharge wetlands, where water comes down in, it's being stored, and then it percolates down through, and through that percolation process, many heavy metals, et cetera, nutrients and stuff get bound to the soil, and acts as a purifier, and replenishes the groundwater. And with recharge wetlands, usually the groundwater is, you know, anywhere between 50 and 200 feet below the surface of the wetland. And then the groundwater can be anywhere between just a few feet thick to up to 500 feet thick with some of the larger aquifers that occur, especially in the central United States. Okay. So all of these contributions and the rate in which water comes down depends a lot on the surface area of the wetland, the soil type, how much you have for hydrologic inputs, and the depth ultimately of the aquifer. All factors that contribute to groundwater replenishment. And then what can we do with that water, being the humans that we are? You know, let's go ahead and capitalize it, and what do? We pump it, and we often irrigate through pivot irrigation systems, which is a much more efficient way, although there's a lot of water loss with this type of pivot irrigation system where it's just spraying out like you see here. They now have ones that have the distribution hose goes much closer to the crop itself, and that helps reduce the amount that evaporates in the air. You can still see this up in many parts of the Midwest where they're just folks are just spraying water everywhere, tons of water loss. Not a very efficient use of water for irrigating. 65% of the high plains area depends on, at least the crops, depend on irrigated water. And in the southern high plains, which is the southern portion of the Great Plains, 95% of those areas depend on pumping from the Ogallala. In fact, this is the area where I worked on my PhD, quite frankly, without pumping from the Ogallala Aquifer, farming would not exist in that area. In fact, it was one of the areas that was last colonized and last developed for row crop agriculture was that area. It's very dry. On average, they get about 17 inches of rain. So that's just not enough, really, for the most part, to grow any crops. So they pour lots of water on it by pumping. And usually about 2 out of 10 years, they actually make a profit. And the remaining years, they get government subsidies. It's not very efficient to plan out in that region. And then it's also used, the Ogallala is used for daily life needs such as drinking water, etc. And that's just in general. Again, aquifers are used all over the world for other basic needs besides just irrigation. All right. Any questions on that? Here's an illustration here of the Ogallala Aquifer. It's the largest aquifer in the United States, extending from Texas. This is the Southern High Plains region, right from here, well, basically from here on down. And then you get into this whole region, it's the Great Plains. You start to get up in the Central Great Plains, Northern Great Plains. And again, the Ogallala runs all the way up into the Dakotas, actually. Huge, huge. Huge underground lake, encompassing 174,000 square miles. It's estimated that there are 3.3 billion acre feet of water. Just to give you a feel for what acre feet is, that's equivalent, 1 acre foot is equivalent to 336,000 gallons. So lots of water underneath of there. Although we're doing a pretty good job at pumping it dry. The wetlands out there that I've referred to before are playa wetlands, especially in basically this region here. There are thousands and thousands of wetlands just in the Southern High Plains region, right in this region here. It's estimated there are around 25,000 of these wetlands. And these are important. They are actually the only way that the groundwater that the Ogallala is recharged in this region. And it's estimated that on average it helps recharge per acre of wetland around 0.5 inch to 3 inches of contribution per acre of wetland per year. Now, unfortunately, we're pumping it much faster. In fact, the Ogallala, it's estimated, is dropping at a rate of about 1 to 2 feet per year from pumping. And this just shows kind of an illustration just through the early 1990s of basically the depth to the Ogallala going from, oh, just around 60 feet to now, well, to the 1990s is about 120 feet. And many of the farmers that I was working with were drilling all the way down to 200 feet. That gets to be pretty darn expensive. The farther you have to pump that water up and having to keep re-drill. So there's still quite a bit of water in these areas, in the Ogallala, but it's getting more and more expensive to pump it. And in some areas, this is like any lake, there are areas that are shallower and deeper than others. So in some areas, it is getting very shallow. So any questions on that? Something that we don't necessarily think about a lot of times in eastern United States, where things tend to be a little bit wetter. Okay, so they can be important areas. Wetlands are important areas for groundwater replenishment. And everybody knows what a recharge wetland is, right? You can explain it to me. Good. Okay. They're also important areas for sediment and nutrient retention. Again, these are areas. Eutrophication is a process of having lots of nutrients input into an area and high primary productivity. It's been estimated that chemical and nutrient uptake of wetland plants, they can remove around 98% of nitrogen and 97% of the phosphorus. So you can have, again, these chemical inputs, these fertilizer inputs that come in, and wetlands can act as a buffer to the aquatic system, preventing things like eutrophication, which again is high primary productivity within the aquatic system, which ultimately can result in lower oxygen levels because of an increased biological demand from biological organisms that respond to, for example, algal blooms. They can improve water quality, also in the capacity of heavy metals and other types of nutrients, because as water percolates again through the soil, it binds with soil particles and ultimately can become a sink. Some wetland plants are highly effective at actually uptaking pesticides and heavy metals, grease and oil. Water hyacinth and cattail have been used in wastewater treatment plants to uptake nutrients and heavy metals. And they can even reduce the amount of E. coli within a system. What else we got here? And climate control. As plants are produced, there's high primary productivity of emergent wetland, vegetation, trees, etc. Of course, atmospheric carbon is converted to organic carbon, and ultimately wetlands themselves can help buffer and help control against global warming, because they can act as carbon sinks through that process. It is estimated that 40% of the global carbon is wrapped up within wetlands. A large percent of the majority of that is in peatlands. And so wetlands act as carbon and nitrogen and sulfurous sinks. If you went and cut and burned all that vegetation, that all would be released into the atmosphere. We have a serious problem. Okay. Questions? Societal values. All right. Trapping and timber harvesting. And that's a picture in northern Michigan. Anybody have an idea what those are? Long, long tails, furry. Don't see them around here. What's that? Beaver? No, it's not a long tail. What's that? An otter. Something you've never seen probably before. These are Fisher and Martin. It's estimated that around 12 million pelts animals are harvested annually for pelts. The majority of those, resulting in about $1 billion in revenue. The majority of those I thought I had that someplace, 10 million of those are muskrats. So the most common animal that is harvested throughout the United States for pelt production is and for economic revenue generation are muskrats. I thought I had a picture of it. Maybe I do down here. Florida, as I already mentioned, as far as trapping and alligator production and alligator farms generates around $16 million a year for Florida, for their economy. And I guess I don't have it. So another thing is timber harvesting. It's been estimated there's around 22 million hectares of hardwood bottomlands in the United States and 13 million hectares within the southeastern United States. This is stuff that's still intact. And you get around $620 per hectare, resulting in a total value of around $8 billion in timber resources in profit just within hardwood bottomlands. And the most productive species we're talking about as far as valuable species are your oak species, especially the red oak species such as cherry bark, willow water, nuttall, and pin oaks are pretty high in timber value. Any questions? Okay. Tourism, recreation and tourism. 98 million Americans participate in outdoor recreation, generating $60 billion annually. Not all that goes to wetlands, but a good percentage of that does. Estimated within Mississippi alone, waterfowl hunting generates $27 million annually just within the state. Folks participate in fishing and crabbing and trapping and even things like wetland tours. There's wetland bird festivals that occur. All these things go towards generating dollars for our country. This is something that is a pretty amazing statistic. This was a paper that was published in Nature, which is one of the top scientific journals in the country. And it came up with the scientist that did this ended up estimating all natural ecosystems at around $33 trillion. Lots of things went into that estimate. Of those, wetland ecosystems accounted for $15 trillion. And so wetland ecosystems accounted for approximately 45% of the realized value of ecosystems and natural ecosystems. And my point is with this is that, remember, wetlands cover 4% of the world's surface. So, I mean, this reflects the multiple uses and the multiple values of wetlands. They're highly productive systems. They're important from an economical standpoint, a biological standpoint, and lots of environmental values. They are some of the most important ecosystems and potentially are the most important ecosystem that we have and are important to manage and to conserve. I don't know what I'm doing there, but all right. Okay. Any questions on that? Comments? So you should be able to, after this lecture, summarize to a landowner, five points of why wetlands are important. And that might be the type of question that you get on the exam, is explain very quickly in, half a page, the five most important things that you think that wetlands contribute to ecosystems, and things that would be sellable, something you want to sell. When you're trying to sell natural to the public, you want to pick things that you think are really important, such as their interest and their attention. Okay. Good. So there are aesthetic values, such as nice sunsets and things like that. This picture right here is a picture of cypress trees on the edge of Bluff Lake at Noxubee National Wildlife Refuge. So we are actually going to go, you're going to be camping not too far from this site right here. And lots of other neat aesthetic values and organisms that, any idea what that is? It is a whistling duck, black-bellied whistling duck. Anybody know what that is? Tiger salamander, yeah. You know what that is? Flamingos. I don't know, what is that? Yeah, it's a fish. Red snapper, probably. Yeah. And moose. Oh, what's that? What kind? Yep, very good. All right, what's that? I don't know what it is. It's a snake. That is, that's a nutria, a freaking introduced species. And bald eagle, scavenger. Yeah, picking up a dead fish from an oil spill. All right. Okay, so that's it, y'all. I see you got done today, and I gave you 45 minutes. I got done early. So that's it for today. So tomorrow we're starting with management. And that's all tomorrow.